Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Pilots Pandemic Podcast. You're here with your host, Emma, and our lovely co-host, Maddie.
Hey, guys.
And this week, we are joined by guest Steve Harrington. Hi, Steve. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So Steve and I actually got connected through the AOPA article. He's the second guest that we've had on where we've been connected in this way. And love mentioning that because, again, the power of connection is just so strong. And I'm just internally grateful for being able to have that spotlight in the AOPA because I've just been able to meet so many awesome people. So yeah, at the start of our show, we always love to ask like all of our guests, where did your passion for aviation start?
For some reason, I always wanted to fly, you know, starting as in my teenage years. And actually that's where I first started. Takes a few lessons in the later part of my high school years. I had another cousin. We were about the same age and we were starting to take some lessons together. Tragically, however, he lost his life in a car accident before we got very far into it. And then I was off to college and the Vietnam War was raging at the time and all kinds of other things were going on. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of money. You know, I had to pay for college, so that kind of put everything on hold for me at that point until much later in life. But that's where things started, and you know, I always, you know, God, I wanted to fly. Actually, interestingly about that is that, you know, if I got drafted to go into the service, and it was 1974, I think, I got drafted. I was in college at the time, and I had decided that. You know, I was in a pre-med track in college, but I had decided that if they were taking me into the service, I was going to sign up for to be a naval aviator. You know, I wanted to fly, you know, fighter jets and land on carriers. As it turned out, when it actually got time to get to report and everything was just about the same time they pulled out of Saigon, mm-hmm. and I got my student deferment back, so I never activated those plans. I got stuck in the something they called the inactive ready reserve, which was one of those Army acronyms that don't make any sense, and nothing ever happened from it. So gotcha. Until much later in life.
How old were you when you were drafted? Do you know like what
age? Yeah, I graduated high school at 17, so 19 years old.
What was that experience like? Like, did you have fear when you got that letter?
Oh, I was, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. That was not, you know, not a very pleasant time in our history.
Yeah.
It was at the end of the Vietnam War, obviously, but, you know, we weren't doing well with that. It had a very bad connotation with it. You know, it was interrupting my plans to become a physician, which was what I wanted to really be my whole life. But I figured if they were going to take me, they were going to give me something, make me do something special with it. So, you know, I was very grateful that history rewrote things for me, and I was able to, you know, they, like I said, gave me back my student deferment and let me complete college and go on through.
That's awesome.
So did you continue down that pre-med route then after the military service you did?
Well, you know, I actually didn't, I never actually got formally inducted.
Oh.
I got my deferment back and that never interrupted. So I went back into my medical career. I finished my, you know, my 4 years of college, went right into medical school and on into training from there. So other than during Desert Storm 1, I spent about 3 months at Selfridge Air Force Base or actually it was more at the 8th Guard, the Light Guard Armory on 8 Mile in Detroit, serving as just filling in for some of the guys who got called up. They activated me for a little bit in that inactive ready reserve thing. But I never, I was helping do physical exams. That was about it.
Okay.
They really didn't know what to do with us. We weren't part of the regular army. We weren't part of the National Guard. We just weren't part of anything. And they just kind of, why are you here?
They put you somewhere.
Yeah.
After you did your military service and then you said you completed your schooling and everything, is that was that your pathway into your cardiothoracic surgery that you are now retired from?
Absolutely was. I went through medical school. Actually, it's kind of funny because in medical school, the rotations, you go through different services, surgery, internal medicine, GYN, radiology, and so forth. The one that I disliked almost the most was my surgery rotation. Okay. I just, I basically thought a lot of the guys who were training me and a lot of the way things were, that they were kind of jerks, to be honest with you. It was difficult. I mean, it was very much a caste system and trial by fire. So I really didn't like it. But then I went into just a general internship. And as luck would have it, some guys, I kind of got a little bit more into the surgery thing. And I became very close with a gentleman there who was a thoracic surgeon who sat me down and talked to me and said, you're really pretty good at this. You ought to think about going into surgery. And I thought about it a little bit and I was having fun. And he became a very strong, he was like a second father, very strong mentor for me. And I decided to go into the surgical pathway. So I don't know if you know about it, but when you're in medical training, you to get a residency or to get a training program, normally you go through a sort of a lottery system and you apply to hospitals and hospitals will evaluate you. And then, try to see where there's a fit. Well, I never went through any of that. I just went down to the medical office. I said, "Do you have any spots in surgery?" They said, "Yes." And I said, "So could I have one?" They said, "Yes." And so that's how I got into surgery. Simple as that.
And, that's wild.
The same thing happened when I got into cardiac surgery. I had a couple offers. I actually had an offer to go out to Beth Israel Hospital in Boston for training, but I would have had to forego my last year of general surgery and come back and redo that. So I didn't really want to do that. So an opening popped up at one of the hospitals in Detroit, one of the training programs there. They had a couple of residents that they had to let go, so they had a couple of openings pop up. So I went in and applied and said, "Can I have the spot?" And they said, "Yeah." And so I went into the training spot without going through it's called the match is what it's called. So I didn't go through the match for that either. It was really kind of interesting how everything kind of fell into place. I think we have purposes in our lives. I really do. And I think there are, and so you can talk about destiny. You can talk about it in religious terms. You can talk about all things you want. But I think we have, I think we've been given talents. I think we've been given opportunities that we need to take advantage of to help each other. I mean, that's our purpose here in this world.
Definitely. It seems like it was like a divine pathway for you since it all kind of fell into place. And really obviously you did it for a long time. And your friend had already said you were really good at that type of surgery. So that's amazing. But did your...
We actually became partners later later on.
Oh, you guys did? See?
Before we retired, yeah.
It came full circle for you guys. Yeah. Wow. Did your background in medicine translate to flying in any way?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah?
Absolutely, because it was part of the things with medicine that got me back into flying later in life. Part of it had to do with the fact that I got kids out of the way and had the opportunities and things, but I went to a seminar at one of the national meetings for our society, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, on how to apply the principles of cockpit or crew resource management to mm-hmm. from aviation into our medical practice. And I became absolutely fascinated with that discipline that aviation provides. And you may be familiar with some of the writings and works of guys like Sidney Decker and Helmrich and others. I mean, it kind of all started back in the 1970s when there was a lot of problems in commercial aviation. I mean, there were significant airplane crashes occurring in the 70s, early 70s. One of them was in Detroit, right? You know, with the Northwest flight, where they lost all but the one little girl in that flight that crashed. And it was due to a pilot error where they failed to, you know, put proper flaps in, and the airplane was too heavy and lost control on takeoff and crashed into one of the highways in a fiery crash. And, you know, just a terrible tragedy. And that's when aviation began to study this stuff in detail, and the whole concept of crew resource and cockpit resource management came into being. So they had this seminar on taking those things and applying it to aviation. It was led by a former top gun pilot who was now working for FedEx, but he had his own little private thing called Life Wings. His name is Steve Harden. And he had formed a small company to kind of push these principles that are out there. And some of the opportunities that we have with the whole thing with working around teamwork, standard operating procedures, communication, and then failure analysis. I mean, those are sort of the foundations for crew resource management. For example, when they looked at aviation errors, they found 70% of the crashes in commercial aviation at the time were due to pilot error. And the number one cause was miscommunication in the cockpit. And when I looked at how in those same things were happening in operating rooms, those same things were happening in emergency rooms, those same things were happening in the ICUs. And I said, this is the perfect setting to reapply those principles. This was in, around 2007, 2008. And that just fired me up. And that's exactly when I got back into aviation.
Didn't they start introducing the checklist into like medicine because of the communication barrier there, where, you know, your nurse might be afraid to say, hey, you're operating on the wrong leg or something like that. So they instituted that checklist just like in aviation for the medical world as well.
Absolutely. Well, you know, none of us are perfect, right? So checklists provide us a way to help ourselves work better and to help us help each other work better. You know, we're in medicine and aviation, they're highly complex. They involve a lot of teamwork, and communication is key. And, you know, there has to be that. There in aviation, one of the problems was the culture of the cockpit, if you remember. Mm-hmm. Nobody dared to speak up against the pilot. You know, and you could have perfectly good airplanes flying into the ground, running out of fuel and other things because the co-pilot wouldn't speak up and challenge the pilot because you just didn't do that. The same thing happens in operating rooms, for example. So being able to have a nurse given permission to be able to step up and stop the line, stop the process and say, I'm not comfortable with this. Something's wrong here. So, you know, that was one of the things that I trained my teams on. I said, we're going to have key words here. And if someone says something, I'm uncomfortable or something doesn't seem right, things stop right there. And until we made sure what we knew what we were doing, just like they do in aviation. So you had to empower your people to be able to step up. And I had to be able to step back and let them do that without them having fear that there was going to be retribution against them for doing so. So you had to develop this whole change in hierarchy. I mean, the captain's still the captain, the surgeon's still the surgeon, but now people can speak up.
Yeah, there's no like ego interfering. It's all about like the mission, which I really appreciate. So with your background in medicine too, the other question I had is a lot of times there are people that want to begin flying or think about flying, but they're really scared to do it because they think, oh, you know, flying is only for smart people. And I mean, I've been subject to that myself. I'm like, I don't know if I could do this. But obviously I'm going to get my PPL this year, but I was wondering if you could expand on any experiences where you had difficulties in learning how to fly.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I started to get back into flying, I'll give you a little bit of the story of how that happened. One of my colleagues who was the chief of cardiology for our health system, and I was one of the chiefs in cardiac surgery, we were asked to work together to develop the Heart and Vascular Institute for the health system. So I'm in his office and I look around and there's all this airplane stuff around. Well, it turns out that here's this colleague of mine that I didn't even realize was a CFII. And I said, well, gee, this is pretty neat. And this is the same time I was starting to look at all this other stuff with aviation. I said, can you take me flying? And he said, yeah, absolutely. And that started the whole flying thing with me. I got in trouble for it because I didn't tell my wife for a little while. it's better to get forgiveness and permission sometimes. But nonetheless, you know, that developed a bond between us and started the whole flying thing. This was like in 2009. And, you know, my flying exploded from there. But what was the hardest thing for flying? I mean, it's not a terribly, you don't have to be smart, but you do have to work hard at it. There's a lot of things you have to memorize. There's a lot of things you have to learn. There's a lot of things you have to think about. And particularly when you start to get into your instrument rating. Instrument rating is probably the hardest rating out there. I think instrument rating is harder than the commercial. But the hardest thing for me to learn how to do in flying, because it's not like driving a car, was land the stupid airplane. I mean, I probably did close to 300 landings, maybe four, before I really started to get comfortable with how to land that airplane. I mean, it's just, there are skills that are there that aren't about being smart. It's about being able to translate the feel of the airplane and understanding physics and, you know, understanding just the aerodynamics of it and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, and I'm not going to say I'm the smartest guy in the world. I'm a hardworking guy, but, you know, I'm not necessarily the smartest guy. But, you know, it really took time to learn how to land that airplane.
Yeah, I always say there's like a joke out there, like one of those bad aviation jokes. So it's like, you know, you take off, but, you know, you can always land. It just depends on how. And I struggled a lot with my landings during my PPL. It took me a while to just get a knack where I felt really comfortable. And it really does take a lot of practice. And it's one of those things where I do feel like practice makes perfect. The more you can do it, the better it gets. And some of the most rewarding flights that I ever had, some of the most rewarding training flights, were just in the patterns, doing just that, taking off, landing, taking off, landing. But yeah, I could resonate with that a little bit. So kind of speaking of difficulties, moving a little bit in a different direction, we know, unfortunately, your third class medical was reissued. Can you kind of walk us through the difficulties that you've had with your medical and what that journey has been like for you?
Well, the difficulty came about a couple of years ago now, almost 2 years ago now, when I started to develop chest pain. And being a heart surgeon, you know, what would happen is I'd ride my bike and I'd do some competitive cycling. I'd ride my bike and after about a mile or two, I'd start to get chest pain. And, you know, it was about an 8 out of 10. So like being a good heart surgeon, I would keep riding. And if I kept, I wouldn't stop. If I kept riding, it would go down to about a 3. And I could ride 20 miles and then when I got off the bike, it was fine. So I kind of knew what was going on. I figured this was something cardiac. But I wasn't quite ready to get it checked out yet. I was down in Florida at the time where I'm living now, and I wanted to go back up to Michigan where I knew the doctors and had some ins and outs with it. So got back up to Michigan and I saw one of my, you know, doctors don't have doctors. We have buddies. Okay. So I saw one of my friends and I said, well, you know, we probably should do a cardiac cath. I said, sure. So, and I figured he's going to find something, pop a stent, you know, a little stent in there, I'll be fine. So we did the cardiac cath and I, you know, you know, the first couple of pitchers did not look very good. And he was done in about 5 minutes. And he said, you know, we're going to take you off the table. We've got to think about what we need to do here. And it, you know, turned out I needed some kind of fancy work done by someone who specializes in complex blockages. And they were able to put stents in and everything went fine. But then during that time, I was also found to be anemic. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew that with the cardiac issues, that right there, that became one of those conditions under third class medical that you have to self-disqualify, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, nobody's from the FAA is going to call you up and tell you that something's wrong here. You have to self-disclose this according to the FARs, if you so choose to. Well, and I wasn't going to try to play games. So I, at that point, I stopped flying. And I looked at the regs, and I knew what I had to do in order to then apply for special issuance. Well, as I said, I had this problem with some anemia that came up, which didn't make any sense. As it turns out, a couple months after that, unfortunately, I was diagnosed with cancer, colon cancer. I went through surgery and then had 6 months of chemotherapy, which I finished about 6-8 months ago. So that becomes another potential disqualifier for the third class medical. The real problem comes into play with this is, how do you talk to anybody in the FAA or talk to anybody that's going to be able to help you through this process of getting your, you know, getting in back in the cockpit? And what does that involve? I mean, it you know, trying to get through the rules and regs and trying to figure this out yourself, and what do you have to send them? I mean, the challenges with this are frightening. They're so much so that, you know, you almost wonder, should I say anything at all? Maybe I can just get by without doing anything and mm-hmm. just not disclose it. And that's the real danger, is that I think there are a lot of people who might do that.
That's the reality for, unfortunately, probably a lot of people. We know a lot of people, you know, and Billy Hoffman, who we've had on this show, has done some case studies, and the data is there that shows that that is actually what is happening right now. Which is crazy, because we know how much the FAA argues safety, but definitely feels like a safety risk.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, basic med, and I love basic med. I think basic med is great. I think it was a real big step forward for the FAA. They didn't get everything right, but, you know, that was an improvement. But in one way, basic med almost encourages you not to disclose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For example, let's say that, you know, I just did my basic med. And so that gives me, you know, that would, you know, give me 4 years, right? I believe now. Is it four or five? I think it's four.
It might be five, but I think you're right.
It's either four or five. I mean, as opposed to a third class, which, you know, after the age of 40 gives you 2 years. So I've just done that. You know, I'm good to go. Okay. I don't have to, you know, I really don't have to do anything for 4 or 5 years. I don't have to see a doctor. I don't have to get a medical. I don't have to do anything. Doesn't that encourage me not to say anything? I mean, you know, let's say that right after that, I have a little chest pain. I go see the doctor. They find one small blockage, put a stent in, I'm fine. But under FARs, that's a coronary condition that disqualifies you. That you have, you know, so you have to, you know, but if you don't disclose, you know, your doctors, it doesn't have to tell the FAA, you don't have to, you know, you don't, you know, how's the FAA going to find out if you don't say anything?
Yeah.
So the safe thing for you, you know, the logic, and I know there's got to be hundreds of guys out there, if not thousands.
There definitely is. I mean,
right now there's estimated, 50 to 70,000 people on basic med. There's got to be at least 10,000 people out there with heart problems who haven't disclosed anything.
Well, that's kind of the advice that I give people, honestly. If they know they have a disqualifying condition, I'm like, well, just get basic med. And I don't know if that's, I don't think that that's wrong. I don't know. It's just that the system is so archaic. Like, and like you said, like, most people, if they know they have something, don't want to tell the FAA because of all of those hoops and bounds they have to go through to get their medical. So I don't blame them for not disclosing. But the other thing is that you can just ground yourself and not say anything until you're better as well, which I think is the smart decision to do.
Well, yeah. Which is basically what I did until I wanted to get myself back in the cockpit. I knew, you know, the process is just so darn long, and it's just so obtrusive. It's so archaic.
Got gut issues? Because Emma and I sure do. I have an issue with high sugar foods and anything with added preservatives, and Emma has a whole ass gluten intolerance. So we struggle with finding tasty treats, but thank the heavens for Abinola, because it has been a lifesaver when we want a sweet treat fix without all the gut bombs that high gluten foods like cookies and cakes give us.
Abinola has a chocolate granola that is made with lupini beans, so it's gluten-free and only has 1 gram of sugar, leaving our sweet tooth satisfied and our tummies feeling perfectly fine.
You guys, you can head over to abby-foods.com or the Instagram account at abby_foods_co for your granola fix turned tasty treat fix. You'll also find all kinds of recipes to try out, so you'll never get bored with Abinola. Use code PILOTSPANDEMIC for 15% off your order of Abinola. So, like, speaking of the process, since you are in the middle of the special issuance process, do you feel like the testing required to retain a special issuance, either for your heart diagnosis or for your cancer diagnosis, do you think that that's over the top? And if so, like, why do you think that?
I'm not sure the process, I'm not sure the testing is necessarily over the top. I mean, basically for the cardiac thing, what they require is that you perform up to a certain level on a treadmill stress test without any EKG changes or other findings. It's called a Bruce protocol on that, which is a fairly basic and simple test to do. It's maybe a little bit over the top in that it's in excess of what I think a lot of people could perform, even under normal conditions. I mean, I see a lot of guys out there that are flying ATP who, if I put them on a treadmill and did a stress test on them, you know, and asked them to go to a stage four on a Bruce protocol, which is, you know, that's going about 10, 11 minutes at a pretty good pace uphill. They probably wouldn't, you know, just based on the fact that they're overweight and several other things, wouldn't pass, even though they've never had any heart problems. They probably just couldn't do it, couldn't physically do it. You know, they'd get out, they'd fail the test because they couldn't make it more than 3 to 5 minutes. Yeah. So it's probably a little bit over the top on that, but it's still a good safety measure. The problem becomes, you know, what are the next steps? And just everything within that is so complicated. And then you start to look at, you know, basically what are there are four or five disqualifying conditions, right? You've got, you know, things that you obviously that really triggers your efforts more than anything else has been the psychiatric ones. Mm-hmm. And you've got neural ones, you know, if you've got, you know, tremors or you've had a stroke or, you know, other things, some things may make sense, some things may not. And then the cardiac ones, you know, heart attack, coronary artery disease, which are, you know, you can have some mild coronary artery disease is not all the same thing. You know, someone who has a small amount of blockage of one artery is not the same thing as somebody who's had a major heart attack. You know, so this whole thing gets lumped together. That's the problem. You know, there's no discerning what's serious and what's not serious in this. You know, what is a highly complicated problem versus what something's very simple. Someone who has as I gave in my example, someone that has a stent put in for a small little branch in the back of the heart is disqualified as much as somebody who's had a major heart attack. They're treated the same. It makes no sense. It doesn't. You know, I think the answer, you know, it just doesn't make sense. And then you've got, you know, the cancer thing. You know, it depends on if you have a high risk situation. What were the findings on the pathology? Is it what state? You know, again, things. What does all this mean? I mean, how do you define that? And then there's a whole question about diabetes. You know, that's nothing like that. You know, yeah. But those are kind of the five things.
It just
doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you bring up that point, because this is, you know, a conversation topic that we touch on a lot, is that the FAA, especially within the past year and a half, they tout the fact that all of these are case by case, which in fact they are not. They're just, it is very simple. And anyone who's been through this knows that they don't treat it as a case by case space, because just like you said, somebody who receives a stent for a minor blockage is going to be treated the same way that's had a heart attack. So it just doesn't really seem to make sense, which brings me back to their flaws with like transparency issues. But yeah, so with your case, you've not only dealt with this heart condition, but you've also dealt with cancer. And I can imagine that dealing with these diagnoses back to back must have weighed on your mind heavily. Did the burden seem heavier when you were trying to navigate the air medical system? And how did you keep your peace of mind, like with all this stress kind of weighing down on you?
I mean, it takes discipline. You're absolutely right. It's very difficult. You know, your life changes overnight. You know, suddenly things, you know, I retired. I thought, hey, life is going to be great. I'm going to be able to fly my airplane. I'm going to be able as much as I want. I'm going to be able to do some things. And then all of a sudden, and particularly with the cancer diagnosis, you're facing a diagnosis where you don't know if you're going to be alive in a year. You know, maybe, you know, depending on the stage it's at and how you respond to treatment. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like your whole world has just changed overnight, and it's the shock. Even though I've had some very good reports, I just had some testing done a week ago. My PET scans are negative. All my blood markers are negative. There's, you know, no evidence right now of any cancer that I have. It never goes out of your mind. You know, you've got this sort of Damocles, if you will, that's all, you know, kind of always hanging over your head. It's always kind of back there. It's like, when it is, and especially as a medical professional, having seen so many people and treated so many people with cancer, you know, you never know when you're out of the woods with this. You just never do. And you're trying to grab every little bit of life you can and enjoy it while you can. And yet you've got these barriers placed in front of you. And the frustrations with this get to be really, really immense. And it is not easy to deal with, and not everybody deals with it very well.
Yeah. I've always wondered, you know, what the reality is like when you are a healthcare professional, knowing everything, like you said, knowing what you know, and then being faced with something like this. I can imagine it adds an element of fear or anxiety that maybe a lot of people don't experience. I know with anything, like any of these heavier diagnoses, something like cancer, I can imagine incites fear in everyone. I feel like each person, but I can imagine it's a little bit heavier when you know the reality very well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you talk about cancer, there are some very specific emotional stages that people with a cancer diagnosis are normally go through. They go through denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Those are the five stages that they talk about classically that you go through. The one they don't talk about that is pervasive, that is the most and difficult one to deal with, is exactly what you just said, is fear. Nobody talks about this.
Yeah.
No, it's fear. And it's, you know, it's, and sometimes it's not just fear of dying. It's fear of how you're going to die.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, what do you, because I watched too many people die from cancer and what they have to go through.
Yeah.
And that's what's difficult.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
It needs to be addressed.
I'm glad that you pointed that out, because that's something I actually never really thought about. And like you said, watching people die from cancer is very sad because it's so slow. And I've had a few people close to me die from cancer, and I don't wish that on anybody.
Yeah.
But with your story, you've been very vocal about it. And I love that you reached out to Emma and I after you found our article and you shared this with us, and obviously are on the Pilots Pandemic podcast talking about it. But we do get a lot of pilots who have a story to tell about the air medical system, but they don't want to tell it because they're afraid that the FAA is going to come after them. And what I wanted to know is how you decided that you were comfortable telling your story and that the fear of the FAA doesn't loom over you.
Well, I think the first thing that's important here, and it gets back to what I said about, you know, we have talents and we have things we have to do. One thing I firmly believe is that silence is affirmation.
Mm.
So, you know, being silent about it just provides affirmation that they're doing the right things already, and they're not.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm, whether I get to fly again or not, and hopefully I do, but whether I get to or not, I'm going to speak out about this. And if I have any opportunities to voice my opinion, you know, I'm going to use it. You know, I also know that I have, you know, and I'm not afraid of the FAA. First of all, sometimes I think they're so confused, I don't think they'll ever figure out what we're talking about here.
It's so true.
Even if they hear me say this, you know, then shame on them. You know, I don't, you know, yeah. I'm not afraid of them. I'm not.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I really am not. But the other thing is, I think if I've got any kind of voice at all, and I, you know, I was just having this conversation with, I was talking to, you remember I talked about my friends, Steve Harden, who did Life Wings and this initial thing, who actually got to be good friends with this. We still keep in contact 10 years later. He was actually one of the liaisons for FedEx for the medical issues and other things in Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, they're so understaffed, and their systems are so archaic that it's just, you know, you're going to frustrate yourself with this. They're not going to figure out anything. So we've got to say something with this. And then I was having another conversation with a good friend of mine who is a local politician back in Detroit. And, you know, I've got some contacts that I'm going to be able to use through him to hopefully with us as a group also talk to some other individuals in Washington. So if I've got those contacts, I want to use them. You know, I want to take advantage of it. Again, I think you're put into situations, you're put into opportunities for a reason. You know, I got into medicine and things, you know, as we talked about, everything that happened to me happened for reasons. This is another thing where there's an opportunity, there's a reason. Maybe I don't understand it right now, but there's a reason.
I definitely,
and I'm going to take advantage of it.
I love that as well. I like to believe for myself, like everything that's happened to me, I'm like, hopefully one day, you know, as tragic as some of the things that have happened, I'm hoping that there's a way to make something more come from it. You know what I mean? I feel like there's always, the most beautiful thing about human beings is we're always trying to find the light in the dark. And I think you had a really beautiful way of expressing that you've been given these opportunities, you're going to take them. And I really liked what you said. And we say a lot on the show, and it sounds a little bit harsh, but we always say, you know, you're not that special. The FAA isn't out to get you. They're not listening and watching your every move. They don't have a dedicated person stalking your Instagram or your social media. And it's like, if you know something is bad, use your voice. And I think we're definitely coming into a time and an era too, where like we are becoming more vocal about issues that we see in our society, systemically, whatever you have it. So I'm glad that you have this approach, but you are a part of our stakeholder group, speaking of, you know, having a voice, and we're so grateful that you've chosen to be a part of taking action in that way. And we know that congressional change is needed, but what are your views on making change in this way? Like, what would you tell our audience is the importance of being involved in democratic processes for air medical reform?
Well, the first thing is just strengthen numbers. Okay. If it's a few people talking, it's a whisper. You know, a few more people begin to listen. And as we grow, you know, then it becomes a voice that people pay attention to. You know, I really think there's some, you know, I'm strongly behind a lot of the things that you bring up in your pillars. And but, you know, particularly we need to talk about, the FAA needs to have some reformation. It's not, everything isn't necessarily their fault. You know, they need to be staffed better. We mm-hmm. talk about that. They absolutely need to be staffed better. They, you know, right now they're working out of paper boxes in the basement of one of the offices at Oklahoma City, basically. Yeah. You know, it's ridiculous with not enough people to begin to look at this type of stuff. And when you start talking about general aviation pilots, you know, their first priority is not general aviation pilots. Their first priority is trying to keep commercial pilots, ATPs, in the air if they can, because of the need for them right now. Okay, so we're, you know, we're taking a second seat to that. I understand that. So, you know, in order, you know, one of the ways we have to fix that is numbers. Second thing is that I think we need to look at is, you know, this, how they function. Right now, when it comes to getting certificated as a, in for a private pilot, you know, you basically have, you've got basic med on one side and you've got a third class medical certificate on the other side, and then you jump to special issuance. And to me, it seems really kind of redundant that the kind of the same things you're trying to do with basic med are the same things you're trying to do with your AMEs with the third class medical certificate. Why can't we, you know, why should there be those two different sources to basically get to the same endpoint? Why can't our AMEs be empowered, and why can't we have a system that works so that they can actually do the special issuance? Why does everything have to go to a handful of people in Oklahoma City?
Yeah.
Why can't we have this system built so I can go in and see a designated medical examiner, aeronautical medical examiner, and he has the guidelines there for him. And maybe he utilizes the resources of my specialist, my cardiologist, or my cancer specialist that I can provide for him that says, hey, he's cancer-free, he's passed his stress test, he's low risk, everything you can think of. There's no reason why he can't be flying an airplane, in my specialist opinion. And, you know, the AME should be able then to give you special issuance. I have no problem with going and seeing an AME once a year, you know, or every 6 months, you know, to just check and make sure everything's okay for the safety of the public and the safety of myself. Yep. But we, you know, this is, you know, there's ways we could fix this. The system is broken. Another thing they need to do, all the guidelines, they need to be based on evidence-based current medical evidence. And it's not. We talked a little bit about, you know, how things just don't make any sense and it's over the top on some of this. And I know that's extremely difficult to try to keep up, and it takes people, but there's got to be a better way. And, you know, and then they've got to, there's so much they could do by just speeding up, you know, if you just eliminated things going to Oklahoma City and having your AME do it, I mean, think of how much time that would save. And they have no timelines. Okay. If I want to apply for special issuance, I have to get my test results into them within 90 days of the time the test was done.
Yeah.
After that, they have no time clock. I mean, I've been waiting now almost 150 days. And you know what I've heard from the FAA?
Zero.
Not one word. Not even affirmation that they got my medical records.
Wow.
Not one word. So I call AOPA and I say, well, what can I do? And they say nothing. I mean, maybe you can go online and see if they've even I know they got him because they signed for him. Somebody signed for him there. Maybe it was a janitor. I don't know.
But probably was,
you know, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I mean, all those points that you hit on, Steve, you know, like, obviously, we are all in the same stakeholder group, so we all agree with what you're saying. But I think it's true, you know, we're giving so much decision making to people that have never even seen your face, you know, they don't even know you as a person or your health. They're just making a decision off of paperwork. And I really think giving more power to the person who sees you, to the AME, to say, hey, I do believe you're fit to fly, given that your, you know, cardiologist or your psychologist says that you're okay to fly, is a better way than your AME being like, well, this is out of my hands. Let me send it to some office in Oklahoma City and we'll see what they say, even though they've never seen you. I just don't think that's right. And that's the problem, is they have so much to do over in OKC and there's only four doctors there that are dealing out special issuances. And now we're at this 2-year waiting period for most special issuances. And it's a big deal to be waiting that long.
I mean, we got roughly 5,400 AMEs out there. I looked up the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States. Empower them. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be bright guys. They had to go to Oklahoma City for a week, right? And go through special courses.
Okay. Yeah.
To do it so they could learn how to do basically the same thing as your PCP does in his office that they already know how to do. You know.
If you have the resources,
the only thing they're really learning is how to disqualify you, and then they have to send everything on. Instead, we should be thinking about it the other way. We should be teaching them how to qualify you safely, not disqualify you.
Yes.
Turn that around. It makes a lot more sense.
You'd think they want to decrease their workload over at OKC, but it just seems they keep piling it on. But for you specifically, what do you think has been the most difficult part of you navigating the special issuance process?
Well, just the lack of response.
Yeah.
I have no problem putting together all the medical records. Although even that was, you know, you can't, I, you know, I had the AOPA, Pilot Protective Services. I've utilized them, and the AOPA offices were very helpful with that. I had them review everything to make sure I was sending the right stuff. All I had to do was send them a PDF file, email, boom, done. FAA won't accept that. Okay, I can't send them a PDF. You know what they do? They take my file, which was about this thick, two dead trees. They take that and they scan it in by hand.
Yeah. They make extra work for themselves. Why?
I can send them the whole thing. Pictures, everything. You know?
Yep.
So that's the most frustrating thing. It's just a lack of response and the time that it takes. Okay. In the meantime, you know, I've got an airplane that I'm paying for and hangar time and everything. It's costing me a lot of money. I can't, you know, I the only thing I can do is sit in the right seat and work the radios with a friend in his plane or in my, you know, or in my partner's plane. He flies and, you know, I play navigator. It's been great practice for me talking to ATC and doing all the, you know, instrument stuff. You know, flying the plane is easy. It's harder parts talking on the radio sometimes, right, Emma?
yeah, literally. If there's one thing that I could do, it's I would literally pay to just sit in the right seat and just redo all of my comms and practice all of that over again, because there is nothing that gets easier. I don't know why, but it's like having to learn a whole new language.
Oh, it's just practice. I mean, fortunately, I do a lot of it out of Naples here, and Naples Airport is very busy. You know, there's a lot of general aviation, jet traffic that comes in and out of here. And like the other day, we were number 6 on approach. Jeez. You know, and that's always kind of challenging because you've got 6 planes that are 7 planes that are faster than you, and we're kind of chugging along in a 182, you know, trying to make 120 knots, and we got these guys chasing up our 6s. You know, doing 175 or better knots behind us. You know, So
this sounds, this reminding me of the story that I told Maddie the other day about my first solo cross country. I was on approach and literally it was like back to back to back, all like commercial aircraft that were way, I mean, I'm in a Diamond 20, so I'm not even going like, I'm going 70 knots on approach. And they're all going, you know, 200, 300 knots. And they're telling me to expedite my taxi. It's like, if I expedite my taxi anymore, I'm just going to take back off.
Well, I know. I mean, you're coming in looking like a Flintstone, you know, plane.
Yeah.
Yep. Cuddling.
Yep. Just like, but,
you know, you
along.
Just tell them, hey, I'm doing the best I can. Unable. You're the PIC. Remember that.
Yep. Yep. They can, I always used to
make,
love you.
They can
so
make
that
180s
word.
As easily as I can make 180s.
Nope. I unable used to be my favorite word when I was a student pilot. Unable and also student pilot. Before every single call, I'd be like, student pilot. never gets old.
That'll buy you a little reprieve until the controllers start to learn your voice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's why I switched schools. speaking of flying, my last question for you is, what is your most memorable flight? Like something that, you know, you'll always take with you.
I think there's a couple. One I haven't gotten to do yet. One is, and this, I won a flight in a L-39 Vidoka, which is a Czech MiG trainer. And then 9/11 hit, and you know all this kind of stuff got grounded, and I've never had a chance to take that jet flight. You know, hopefully someday my bucket list is I want to hop in an F-16. Mm. You know, I want to get a ride in an F-16. You know, with the Blue Angels, with the
Thunderbirds. Aeroshell or what is that? Well,
Thunderbirds would be F-16s. F-18s are the Blue Angels. I would do an F-18 too. I mean, one of those.
You're like, not the Blue Angels.
So, you know, if I get in tight with some congressman who's got some pull, I'll pull that off. You know, I'm not sure that's going to happen. But anyway, that would be my bucket list. But one of the most memorable flights was I took a cross-country flight a few years back with a good friend of mine who had a Cessna 310 Ram conversion, pressurized twin engine plane. We went from Detroit to Las Vegas and back through Durango. And, you know, so you got a cross country flight with mountains and, you know, Hoover Dam and just all kinds of, it was just beautiful, beautiful scenery. All kinds of challenges along the way with the flight. I was flying right seat. I didn't have my twin rating or anything then, so I couldn't fly left seat, but I was in the right seat, and you know, I actually got to do a little bit of flying, even though, you know, it was when I was up there, you know, when he had to go back to the back to use the restroom, you know, I kept the plane straight and level anyway. So that was really a great flight. But then the other one that was kind of, it always sticks in my mind, is I was coming back from University of Illinois, Champaign, Illinois, back to Detroit. And I had my three-year-old granddaughter was in the back seat with us. And this is in the 182. And we're coming back, and this is in May. It's pretty nice most of the flight, but we get to Pontiac, which is just north and a little bit west of my home airport, north of Detroit, which is a little airport called Romeo. It's only about 15 miles between the two by air, but there was just a little rain squall and kind of a little bit sleety. And it wasn't, you know, I wasn't above the clouds. I was only about 2,500 feet. I was already on a kind of approach, and it was a little bit of sleet, and I started to pick up a little bit of ice, which, you know, I'm not, but this plane is not going to fly through ice.
Yeah.
And accumulate very much. You know that. But it wasn't a whole lot. And we were close, and I just kind of dodged around and got it, but I still had a little bit of ice on there. So we're coming into approach, and I know I've got some ice on things. I can see it. And I don't want to have a tailplane stall and all those things I talked to you about. So I kind of keep the configuration the same. You know, I use as minimal flaps as I could. And so basically I just come in hot.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm this is a carrier deck landing and, you know, tail hook landing and coming in hot just to make sure I get her down. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit jumpy on the landing, and but granddaughter in the backseat who's got the headsets on and everything, we, you know, come to a stop and she says, "Papa, that was fun. Can we do that again?"
Yeah. I was about to say, I bet she's having the time of her life, completely blissfully unaware.
Unaware of, you know, how dangerous it could have been if we'd gone any further. But
yeah. That's well, that so would be cute.
That one has always kind of stuck with me.
Yes. She likes that adrenaline rush. That's me too.
I know.
I'm blissfully unaware as a passenger.
I could never do half of the stuff that I used to ask my dad to do when we would fly together when I was little, like 6-7 years old. And I was like, "Dad, like loop-de-loop, loop-de-loop." And we were literally doing loop-de-loops in a J3 Cub with no harness, no nothing, no parachute. But hey, my dad was having the time of his life. I was too. I think there was one time, one of the first times we ever did it, you know how the Cub, it has, the yoke is like that big stick. And I was leaning forward and my dad pulled back on that yoke and popped me right in the mouth. Almost busted my front tooth. I'll never forget holding back those tears and holding back that pain, because I knew if I cried, my dad would never do it again. And I was obsessed. So I was like, I held those tears back. I was like, we have to do this again. But
did he even know he popped you in the mouth, or were you sitting behind?
I was in the back. He was always sat in the front. Okay. Whenever we flew the Cub. Yeah.
So he never saw you back there.
Nope. He was also blissfully unaware.
It all worked out.
But yeah, I'm so glad. I love that story. And those are the kind of memories that you'll keep forever. And I guarantee she'll remember that for the rest of her life.
Well, I'll send you a picture of her.
For sure.
I'll send you a picture from that flight of her in the backseat with her headlight set. So yes. It's a great picture.
Love that.
Well,
all right.
You want to move on?
We're moving into fun cues, and I need them very medically fit, you know, like that's, I was thinking, what's some fun doctor questions I can ask you? So the first question I have for you is, if you were to watch a show on medicine on Netflix or any streaming service, what would it be? And an example is Grey's Anatomy, because, you know, that's the most popular one. But do you ever watch any medical shows?
Honestly, no. Because most of them are so kind of hokey and not very realistic. And I just kind of cringe.
Yeah. You're like, that's not how it goes.
No, it's you know, there are some things that happen we won't talk about. It's like what things in Vegas stay in Vegas.
Oh.
for the most part, a lot of it just isn't realistic. There was one show that was back in, oh God, had to be in the 70s. No, it was in the 80s. It was in the 80s.
Okay.
It was called Saint Elsewhere. And you guys may have never heard of it.
Mm-mm.
It preceded Grey's Anatomy and all these shows.
Yeah.
And I think it actually was a spinoff from another TV show that never really made it, called Scrubs.
Oh, okay. 100% I remember sure. Scrubs.
You remember Scrubs? Yeah. Scrubs may have actually come from that. You know, maybe in the other way.
Yeah.
But Saint Elsewhere was actually came from a book written by a guy by the name of, his pen name is Samuel Shem, and the book was called House of God, and it was about his first year experience in Beth Israel Hospital in Boston.
Oh.
And if you haven't gotten that, if you should, it's kind of like required reading, you know, for every medical resident that's ever out there, because it's just tells it the way it is, you know. You know, there's little phrases in there like Gomers go to ground. And Gomers never die, you know, they just keep coming back. All kinds of, you know, just things that are kind of the colloquialisms that are in the medical lexicon of those of us who go through training. And it was something you could really relate to, because that was a very real show. Samuel Shem wrote some other books too. You know, he's actually, his real name was Joseph Bergman. He's a physician. He's actually a psychiatrist. He's written several other books. Might be someone interested you actually might want to get in touch with. Because he might have some empathy and some insight into some of the things that you're thinking about, particularly with related to psychiatric illnesses and medicine. You know, he's you know, very good writer. But that was the one show that I actually would watch. The rest of them, nah, forget it.
I actually grew up watching ER with George Clooney. You remember that show?
Okay, yeah.
In the 90s. Loved it. I'd watch that, and then there was actually another show called Emergency 911, which was like real life emergencies, and I just love that. I watched that when I was like 6 years old. My mom was a nurse, so I grew up in a hospital myself, back when they let nurses bring their kids to the hospital and just sit them in a hospital bed while they worked. But yeah, those were my two favorite growing up. And then my most recent one was Nurse Jackie, which is very dark, but I've watched that series twice through. And I really liked it because it does happen. Nurses get addicted to meds that they dispense to their patients. So I just thought that was an interesting dynamic, in that show. But what about you, Emma? Do you have any like favorite medical shows that you've watched?
I obviously watched Grey's Anatomy because like what female hasn't watched Grey's Anatomy, but I kind of stopped watching it. I don't know. I'm a little bit of a hypochondriac, and that was just too much death. It was like, I was constantly thinking about like medical conditions, and then like, there's so much death and dying and like sadness right in your face. And one thing that I've noticed recently is like, if I'm going to sit down and watch TV, like I want to low-key disassociate. I don't want to think about all the sad realities of life. I want to watch a dog play with its owner, or something like sweet and light, or The Real Housewives, or Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
You want to escape reality.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Which is funny because I do that by watching reality TV. But yeah, I'm not into it. I really did like Grey's Anatomy back in the day, but I think after my dad died and like having those experiences with like being in the hospital, it like heightens that awareness almost. So I just couldn't do it at a certain point. It like stressed me out too bad.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I'm like morbid in the things that I like to watch, because it's like either medical shows or like murder. That's like my two favorite. I'm like, what's wrong with me? But anyways, there's a lot of things wrong with me. We know that. Okay, so next question for you, Steve. Out of all the doctors, which one scares you the most? Because I know that doctors and nurses make the worst patients. So are you scared of like a specific doctor, or are you good and you don't have any?
No, the only one I was scared about in the list that you gave me was gynecologist, because I figured if I was seeing the gynecologist, I was going to be in real trouble.
That was for me and Emma.
But, you know, nobody likes to go to the dentist. Come on.
I love the dentist. I used to be an assistant. I think that's why.
I just don't like the dentist. You know, they tell you to put your hand up if it hurts, and you put your hand up and they slap it down anyway. So
yes. Oh, that's funny.
Other than that, you know, no. I will say this. I mean, you know, being a physician most of my life, and most of my life pretty healthy, I never had doctors. Now that the shoe's on the other foot, going to see physicians, it's been challenging, let's put it that way. And challenging in that, you know, you no matter how they want to treat you like another patient, you're not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not even the same as talking to another professional. I mean, a physician talking to a lawyer, even though it's a very educated person or a, you know, very educated businessman, they still don't know much about medicine. But, you know, another physician talking to another physician, it's a whole different animal. And that has probably been the most, it's been very eye-opening, but also very frustrating for me. Because, you know, they kind of, you know, I remember when I went in to see one of the first cancer doctors, you know, it was like, I got this lecture about, and I hadn't even said anything yet. Okay, they knew I was a physician. I mean, it's in the history there. But I didn't say anything. I got this whole lecture about, I'm the doctor, you're the patient. And you better, you know, do what I, you know. It's like, really? I'm okay, fine. Okay, what did I do? Okay, you're going to chastise me already, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm not asking for special treatment. I'm not talking about that. But I do, you know, there's just a, you do feel like you've given so much to the profession that the profession does owe you a little bit of courtesy back.
Oh, for sure. I totally agree with you on that. So is it hard, like, since you have all this knowledge, is it easier for you to advocate for yourself, or do you feel like you get more pushback because you know so much?
No, I feel like I get pushback. I really do. It's like, we know that, you know, you get this. We know that. You don't have to tell me that. You know, I'll give an example today. I just called today. I have an appointment tomorrow with the, you know, my 6-month follow-up with the oncologist. And when I looked at the appointment schedule, they didn't have any labs scheduled. So I called the PA, you know, you don't get, you know, I don't call the doctor directly. I call the PA like I'm supposed to. And I say, I just want to let you know, when I look at the schedule, I didn't see if there were any labs ordered. And, you know, can you check and see if you want to have something so that, I don't get there tomorrow and then it delays things because, oh, we got to get some labs. We forgot to order them, blah, 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 blah. And it was like, again, I almost was getting in my, no, the labs are there. Don't worry about it. Okay, well, I'm sorry. I didn't see it. I mean, I can't see it when I look into my electronic medical record portal, you know, that we all have now, right?
Yeah.
That you're supposed to go through to communicate with and so forth. And, you know, I really think that we've lost a lot, as an aside, with being able to communicate personally with our patients, COVID didn't help this at all. But, you know, physicians are stuck with their nose in the computer, and they don't even look at their patients anymore when they're sitting and talking to them.
Yeah.
It's become so depersonalized. We treat this thing here, this computer, and you know, we don't treat the person who's sitting right there, you know, that we need to talk to.
That's such a good point. I didn't even think about that. Like, every experience that I've had, like going to the doctor, especially within the past 3 years, like, I think I've made eye contact like 2 times, but the rest of the time they're just looking at the computer and typing while I talk. And then I always wonder why I get so emotional. I'm like, well,
are they even paying attention to me?
You know? Yeah.
Are they hearing me? Are you hearing me? You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole reason I go to a naturopathic doctor, because they actually schedule in the time to talk face to face with me. And that's not the same in a hospital. They've got to turn numbers because that's what's required of them. And a lot of times those young doctors too, they feel that time crunch. You see a patient for 15 minutes and you move on to the next one. So I totally get it. And that's kind of frustrating. But Emma, do you want to answer what doctor scares you the most?
Kind of easy. Like,
yeah.
This most traumatizing freaking place in the entire universe. Like, literally, oh my God, I hate that place. And I don't even think it's like, well, it is. It's the experience, everything that you got to go through when you go there. But it's really more or less the fact that I could come to them with a very serious problem, and they're going to tell me birth control. For everything that I say, yep. It's always, well, what about birth control? Birth control. Birth control. I could be like, every single day I wake up and I'm nauseated and I poop pellets. And they'd be like, birth control.
It's so terrible.
And it's so frustrating because I'm like, again, are you even listening to me? Like, yeah. It's like the experience, everything that you have to go through, but it's also the fact that I don't feel like women's health in particular, just from my experience, I have never felt validated. I've never felt heard. I don't feel like they genuinely want to get to the root of any of my problems. It's always just been, well, birth control, or why don't we try an IUD? I'm
like, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, that's it for me. I bet you probably would say the same thing. I could be wrong though.
For me, yeah, I mean, who loves the gynecologist as a woman? It's just never a fun experience. Yeah, I would say low, like if I had to go to the eye doctor, I've never had to, but I feel like dealing anything like close to my eyes, like that would bother me. For some reason, I feel like I would have a problem with the eye doctor, but thank God I don't have to go. So yeah, it's the gyno for me, because the dentist, I fall asleep in the dentist chair. So I don't have any problem with the dentist.
That's psycho, bro. That's psycho.
I think it's my trauma from when I was younger. I jumped off my roof onto a trampoline and busted my two front teeth. And that was like when I was like 8 or 9. So my dentist was awesome though. I mean, you would never know that I have three fake front teeth. So I think that was like, he gave me a great experience with that pain and trauma. And so now I love the dentist. But yeah, the eye doc for me. But moving on to the last question, Stephen, mm-hmm. What's one healthy practice you think has the most impact on your health?
I'll answer that in 1 second. I'm going to tell you just a quick, real quick, another little story. When I first started out as a resident, was in the GYN service. And it was actually one of the gynecologists who told me to go into surgery.
Interesting.
That I should be going into surgery. So I actually started out as one of the bad guys. But
what was that?
The bad guys.
Do you think, okay, so I have to ask, like, why do you, I know with like hormonal balance, I know like your hormones, all of that, progesterone, estrogen, all of that really, really impacts your health. But why do you think I feel like it's been a trend within the past 10 years. Why do you think birth control is such a popular go-to for OBs?
I haven't got a clue. I really don't. You know, I didn't want to go into OB-GYN because I didn't want to be operating on the same organ day in and day out.
Yep.
What did I do? I went into heart surgery.
Heart.
But anyway, I digress. To answer your question, Maddie, you know, the one healthy heart practice, really simple. I mean, number one, I think is a healthy diet. And number two is daily exercise. Real simple. And it doesn't have to be much. I mean, even if you just, you know, walk a block a day, you know, do a couple of walks a day. You know, any kind of just regular kind of exercise is what you need to do, and just a good diet. And there's a lot of diets out there. I think that, you know, the smartest thing is all things in moderation. Doesn't mean you have to have these all kinds of special diets.
But that is the best advice. I think a lot of people think, oh, I got to cut carbs out. I got to cut alcohol out. I got to cut sugar out. And that moderation tidbit is so big in being healthy. As someone who has background in nutrition and personal training, moderation goes very far in keeping you healthy. And then I think one other thing that I would say for one healthy practice that I think has the most impact on health is sleep. I think that is something that is very underrated that people don't think about, but sleep is key to health.
No, I would agree with you. I think sleep is terribly important. My problem is that, you know, 40 years of taking phone calls all night long, and I think my sleep patterns are so permanently
set in stone.
I just, you know, sleep is just, you know, not something that I can't sleep. You know, I, like last night, I woke up 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm awake for like 2 hours and then back to sleep. And that's been my, you know, I can't undo that.
You've wired yourself that way. Mm-hmm. I have also wired myself to be a very early morning person from working, as a ramp service agent. We had to wake up, or I had to be at the airport at 3 a.m. And so I'd often get up at, you know, 2 a.m. to be there at work. And I've never been able to like sleep in past 7 a.m. now. It's just set in stone.
So you were a ramp rat, or you worked?
I was here at Bellingham Airport, north of Seattle. I used to work on the ramp, and then I also was a customer service agent, worked in cargo. You kind of do everything at the small airports here. But yeah, I did that for 2 years. That's how I kind of got my kick into aviation.
Well, I put myself through college working for, when FedEx first got started, my employee number for FedEx was number 60. I was at Pittsburgh International Airport, and I was a ramp rat.
Wow.
I parked airplanes.
Oh, yeah, that's fun.
They gave me 2 flashlights. I had no idea what I was doing.
The trust factor was high there.
I mean, and FedEx didn't even have their own planes hardly at this time. They had a few Falcons of their own, but otherwise there was everything in the world coming in, from DC-3s to Learjets. I mean, anything they could find to pack some kind of something into, because we were a local hub for the Northeast, is, you know, what would come in there at night. So planes would start showing up about 8 o'clock in the evening, and we'd have them all out by 6 o'clock in the morning.
That sounds so much fun.
Real.
The only good part was we could, if we didn't have anything to do the next day, you could hop a ride. As long as you got back for work, they didn't care.
See, that'd be so much fun.
I flew jumps in a bunch of places.
Oh my gosh. I cannot even imagine. That sounds like a freaking blast. I would love to do that. But the glory days of aviation. Well, I was going to say, like, I really don't have a healthy, like, I was going to say drink water, because I carry my, I have like a, I don't even know how many ounces it is. It's a massive Yeti container. And you won't catch me without that thing. Like, I carry it everywhere with me. I always have my bottle of water. I call it my sippy cup. And it is, it's my little sippy. I'm always drinking water. So I would say that's good, but I'm going to give a little alternate spin. And I would say one thing that I feel like for me personally has just been taking care of, like, my skin, very therapeutic. Like, I will not get out of the shower without putting on moisturizer all over my body. I take time to, like, sit and gua sha my face and, like, try to drain my lymphatic system in my face and in my neck. And it really does make me feel good. Like, a lot of the times when I get home from work and it's late, I find it really, really hard for me to unwind, but getting in the shower and, like, going through that whole process, really helps me unwind. And I think it's, like, just taking time to put into yourself, which makes me feel good. So that's my little healthy thing.
I love that. But I love skincare. You know me. I'm always getting you skincare stuff for your gifts.
Literally, that's what I use. I'm like, it's funny. The skincare product that you get me, Maddie, which is the Truly, like the whipped Truly body butters, they're kind of like, it's like a thick consistency. So you really have to take your time to, like, rub it into your skin. And that's another tidbit, like, I would say as a piece of advice, like, if you want to take time, like, get a product that you actually have to think about moisturizing and, like, putting it on your body. Cause I'll always give myself a little massage and, like, I don't know. It's just, it's very nice. And taking the time to, like, connect with myself a little bit. So I love that. I love that. All right. Well, on that note, that is it for this week's episode. Again, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. And I just want to remind everyone, like, please, if you are dealing with a similar struggle or you're dealing with the air medical system any way, shape, or form, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. Like we said, Steve is part of our stakeholder group, and you could be too. So definitely reach out. As always, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. It helps us spread our message far and wide and be able to connect with more people like Steve and share their stories. So we always appreciate that. Maddie, is there anything else that you'd like to touch on?
You know, like, sign our petition and write an affidavit if you feel like it. I think those are the big things, is like being able to tell your story like Stephen just did today. We really appreciate you guys having that bravery to come out and share the issues with the air medical system, because that's the only way that they will change is if we tell the stories of what's happening. So yeah, I'll just reiterate what Emma said. Please, you know, rate, review, subscribe, and definitely let us know if you want to tell your story.
Thank you, Maddie. And thank you again, Steve. That is all for this week. Remember to keep that blue side up and the brown side down. We'll see y'all next week.